Hello.
Hello.
Hi, this is Tina over here in Tucson. With whom am I speaking?
This is Marguerite O'Neill in Canada.
Oh, hi, Marguerite. You're in Canada. I didn't know that. I hope it's cooler than it is here.
It's getting really cold.
Yeah, I bet. Where are you in Canada?
I'm near Toronto. I'm actually in a city called Ottawa.
My husband spent a lot of time in Canada, and he always trying to coax me to go to Toronto. He said it's just a fabulous city. But
it is.
I know. I went up to Quebec many, many, many decades ago, actually, and to watch a stepson play at a hockey tournament, a young boy.
Hey.
And I was just amazed at how polite and kind everybody was. I still remember it. Lovely people. So hopefully you're surrounded by lovely people.
I think so, but then I'm biased.
Well, let's see. Dave should be joining us any second, I guess.
I think so,
Have you been doing coaching for a while?
No, I was a VP of HR, and so in my role I did do quite a bit of executive coaching, actually just doing it now as a business.
Nice. I haven't quite completed the CTA course, and Dave is my instructor. Dave's my instructor.
Oh.
So I work as a
psychotherapist. Welcome, everybody. Don't let me stop good gossip. Keep going here.
I work as a psychotherapist, and I'm trying to add more life coaching in. Well, I am already, actually.
One of my missions is to convert therapists, analysts, psychologists, social workers, psychiatrists to coaching, because I know how well it works. So that's great. Well, what kind of questions or thoughts do you have about what we've talked about so far? Is this what you expected, or are you finding it useful?
Well, it's Marguerite from Canada.
Thanks. Go ahead.
And I actually have started to rewrite parts of my website to align with some of what we're learning. And it was very timely because I was just about to launch the website.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's interesting. You know, I'll share an experience with you. I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad it's helpful in that regard. You know, I usually do like a teleseminar series like this, maybe two or three or four times over a period of many months or a couple or 3 years. I did this series about three times until I realized that, and this was gathering more information and applying it better and that sort of thing, and then I realized I was not actually applying the principles that I was learning to the marketing of this series. And when I did that and revised my landing page, this was the last time, like several months ago, that I did this under my own umbrella. When I revised it and changed it around to reflect the principles that I had learned, I had eight times the subscription as my best before that. So it works. And the landing page that you can see for this, it's pretty much the same as the CTA, but the landing page that I've used and use as kind of a prototype, as an example for me at least, is mentorpath.com/massive success. Just MASSIVE, success. Oh, I wanted to respond to a couple of questions. Thank you for the kind words for those of you who have sent emails. And I wanted to respond to a couple of questions that I got by email about examples, other actual examples of influence and persuasion that have worked. And I was thinking about some of my mentor coaching clients, and then I landed on something that I think is a classic example of influence and persuasion. See how many, and this is a story, like a 2-minute story, see how many of the elements that we've discussed that you can identify. Tom Sawyer is whitewashing a fence under strict orders from his Aunt Polly. A neighborhood kid named Ben walks by and teases Tom about his afternoon plans. Ben said, "Say, I'm going swimming. Don't you wish you could? But of course you'd rather work, wouldn't you? Of course you would." Tom contemplated the boy a bit and said, "What do you call work?" "Why, ain't that work?" Tom resumed his whitewashing and answered carelessly, "Well, maybe it is, maybe it ain't. All I know, it suits Tom Sawyer." "Oh, come on now. You don't mean to let on that you like it." The brush continued to move. "Like it? Well, I don't see why I oughtn't to like it. Does a boy get a chance to whitewash a fence every day?" That put things in a new light. Ben stopped rubbing his apple and nibbling his apple. Tom swept his brush daintily back and forth and stepped back to note the effect. Added a touch here and there, criticized the effect again, Ben watching every move and getting more and more interested, more and more absorbed. Presently, he said, "Say, Tom, let me whitewash a little." Tom considered, was about to consent, but he altered his mind. No, I reckon it wouldn't hardly do, Ben. You see, Aunt Polly's awful particular about this fence. Right here on the street, you know. But if it was the back fence, I wouldn't mind and she wouldn't. Yeah, she's awful particular about this fence. It's got to be done very careful. I reckon there ain't one boy in 1,000, maybe 2,000, that could do it the way it's got to be done." And you know what happens next. Ben is ignited, setting off a contagion of influence that ends with Tom happily observing as the neighborhood kids barter and beg for the chance to whitewash the fence in his stead. So, here are the elements that I see, the essential elements of influence and persuasion. Liking. Obviously, Tom's a likable guy. Most obvious that he likes himself, and that's contagious. Scarcity. He moves from liking, relatedness, and connection quickly to scarcity, emphasizing his autonomy and certainty. He demonstrates his mindset of enjoyment. He speaks and acts committed and consistent. He embodies reciprocity from his position of authority. The contagion of social proof frames the conversation. And Tom definitely is an expert at managing the state of others. We're going to be talking about that in this seminar, beginning with himself, then Ben, then the legion of whitewashers. Each now belongs to a new, highly motivated group to engage in a meaningful endeavor. So that was the best example I could find that embodied some of those principles that that we talked about in a classic story. Any other thoughts or questions or comments before we move into our topic? I'm interested in the things that are resonating with you, or the questions and clarifications that you have, or additional things that would be helpful to talk about.
So hi, David. Hi.
And
hi, guys.
Welcome. I heard. I heard
Tina.
Tina, yeah, go ahead and then Guy. Go ahead.
So I saw an overarching action of rewriting the story of what he was doing. It was just very straightforward, and the elements that you said were all there, but he reframed the story.
Exactly.
He showed excellent tricks for persuasion. And it may also have influenced Tom Sawyer, by the way, I thought. When I listened.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I was thinking before we started that, in fact, when we get together and we do this, honest to God, I don't even know what I'm hearing or how I'm going to use it. But I do understand this incredible machine of learning that I have.
Could I get a management of the background noise, please? Your microphone is picking everything up. I'd like to not go to lecture mode until we're ready for that. So I need a management of the background noise. Go ahead, Tina. You weren't quite finished.
Thank you for managing that, because I, you know, with the hearing problem I have, that makes it super hard. So I was thinking, as I've been taking this particular series of lectures and discussions from you, I actually have no idea a lot of the time what you're talking about, but I have incredible faith in my mind's ability to learn. And I felt that I should sign up for it, and I bet I'm learning all kinds of things. How I'm going to use it, I have no idea. So I don't have questions yet.
Well, that's a great way to do it. And as you know me by now, not knowing has never kept me from talking. So I agree pretty much. So that's a great idea, and to absorb it and to see, you know, and you're talking about chaos theory. In the end, it will all make sense. But
yes, I believe it.
An organizing framework that evolves along with an understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Guy, you had a comment.
Hi, Dave. Yes, I like what you just said. In the end, it will all make sense. Because like Tina, I'm taking all of this in and looking at how I'm going to forge it into what I'm currently doing. And when I say looking at it, I haven't even thought about that yet. I'm just taking everything in right now. But what I liked about the Tom Sawyer story and just the words you used, you talked about likability, centering, engagement, autonomy, commitment, persistence, reciprocity, all of those things really one tie into coaching, but also, you know, we're so focused many times on the coaching aspect of the business that the marketing component and how to utilize all of those key ideas are so important to just being successful at what we're doing. So I'm really enjoying the process and just taking in as much information as I can.
Thanks very much for saying that. I appreciate it. And here's a variant of chaos theory. In the end, everything will be okay. If it's not okay, it's not the end. So keep that in mind. Okay, we're going to go to lecture mode and save some time at the end for discussion. So jot down anything that you have. We're talking about mindset mastery development, and the summary is the little quote under the title in your outline. People do not buy products, they buy states, states of mind. Here's a quiz to begin. Carnegie Mellon University did a large study to determine the major factors for professionals earning the trust of others. What do you think was most important for earning trust? An established, proven expert? Confidence of the professional? Demonstrated current expertise of the professional? Or reputation? Hold on to your answer. By mindset, I'm really talking about a set of assumptions and beliefs that determine how we perceive, process, and behave. A state of mind is like a software program. So analogous to the software program of each state of mind, our mindsets consciously and unconsciously determine our choices. Elite athletes know how to get themselves in an optimum state before going on the court or the field and how to sustain it. There's a blog that is that I'm posting in the morning about self-talk, and that relates to this, but we won't be covering that. So look at my blog, and there's another example or two from athletes, and sign up for the blog if you're interested. Masterful actors, speakers, storytellers do this as well. Manage states of mind. Getting in state is mental, emotional, and physical. A significant persuasion and leadership competency is self-regulation and self-management. Knowing your own skills and deploying them effectively in a mindset specifically matched to the task. So let's look now specifically at mindset strategies of successful persuasion. How do you get a potential prospect you may not even know or don't see in a state of mind to consider your service or product? The next time you want someone to get on board with your idea or service, simply tell a story where you spell out the best outcome. We now know from the mind and brain sciences that storytelling is the most powerful way to plant ideas in someone's mind. Stories are how we make sense of things and how we remember. Stories engage emotionally and explain logically. So it's balanced, right and left brain. When we're being told an effective story, it activates not only the language processing areas, but also the areas used in experiencing the events of the story. Someone tells us how delicious a peach is, and our sensory cortex lights up. When it's about emotion, our right neocortex gets active. When the story character grabs an object, motor neurons fire. When the character observes a scene, vision-related neurons fire. A story puts our whole brain to work. Stories affect us mentally as well as physically. Ann Crindle at the Dartmouth Brain Lab showed how viewers' brains resonated with a specific emotion enacted on the screen. When the central character was angry, the viewers' brains registered anger as well. When the scene was sad, the viewers' brains corresponded. Whenever we feel disgust, that brain region, the anterior insula, fires. That's how the whole area, the whole arena of mirror neurons was discovered, by seeing how the experience of one monkey registered in the brain of the monkey that was observing. This means that getting in state needs to be before you engage your reader or listener. Relax your body, control your breath, get solidly grounded to access the optimum state of mind for a particular task. The primary reason to get in state is to concentrate your energy on a full, undisturbed immersion in your engagement. People like, respect, trust, and are influenced by those who have the ability to remain calm, thoughtful. This default setting to remain centered and grounded no matter what becomes an essential success paradigm. Like any state of mind, it's contagious, amygdala to amygdala. Regulating your own state of mind in a sustained way is the most effective influence on someone else to do the same. So let's look now at some mindset tools of persuasion. There are four principles that we're going to discuss the remainder of this seminar. And I want to summarize them now. The context always is authenticity. It's the most valuable gift you have to offer yourself. One, rapport. For a long-term impact, establish authentic, caring, and emotional investment. Ask what you can do for someone. Highlight mutual interest. Maybe tell a story that involves a challenge. Two, ask questions. Redirect the focus, if it's on problems, to possibility. Appreciative inquiry. Move to a mindset of openness and exploration. The focus determines the state of mind. Paint a picture of a positive outcome. When people imagine, it becomes real for them. Three, personal congruity. What you say verbally and non-verbally have to match. The person who feels the most certain is the greatest influencer. And four, state management of yourself and to impact emotions, state of mind of the prospect. Now, let's talk about these and apply them in a workable way. The two most important determinants of success, beliefs and state management. Let's first explore beliefs. Belief is the blueprint, the software of the unconscious mind. Belief is the mind's command to the brain. Focus aligns the energy field of the brain, and repeated focus rewires the brain. This is the way belief becomes an anatomical reality. Beliefs then determine what we will or won't do. What we believe, the meaning we feel certain will come from situations, determines how we behave and what we do. Social neuroscientists show us that we have to believe in what we're selling, or we won't sell. So how can you create a new belief? The oak sleeps in the acorn. Success comes to those who become success conscious. Failure enhances when there's focus on the negative, on problems. Remember, from both neuroscience and quantum physics, we get what we focus on, not what we want. The only known method of voluntary conscious development of belief is repetitions of affirmations to your unconscious. We come to believe what we repeat to ourselves, whether it's true or false. If a lie is repeated, it ultimately is experienced as the truth. The teller ultimately can't tell the difference. This neuroscience principle emphasizes the need and power of positive focus. Visions are the seedlings of reality. If you can't see significant wealth in your imagination and your vision, you're not going to see it in your bank account. Systematic, repeated visualization rewires the brain. Affirmations are stories that support the visualizations to revise mind software. You're not ready for something until you believe you can acquire it. Belief can be inscribed by affirmation or repeated instructions to the unconscious mind. Repetition of affirmations to your unconscious is a powerful method of voluntary development of belief. Any thought that is repeatedly passed on to the unconscious mind is finally accepted. This is why you don't want to focus on the negative, because you get what you focus on. This is as true for wealth accumulation as it is for other consistent repetitions such as crime. So there are basically two types of belief. One, global beliefs. These are statements that begin with life is, people are, I am. Each affects the way we look at and interpret things and their meaning, because we're going to find something that makes it true. And second type of belief is rule, cause and effect beliefs. If this, then that, or if then. We have brain algorithms of behavior, emotional, and attachment patterns that couple cues and responses that become our shadow story. So we need to know and be aware of these algorithms. People will say yes much more readily to your belief than to your information or your technical skills, sales skill put together. They come to believe what you believe. So the first sell is to yourself. Selling is a transference of emotion. You must feel certain to make someone believe. The primary way you convince someone else is if you're convinced. You will transfer whatever state of mind you're in, doubt or confidence. The second difference between success and failure, state management. Here's an everyday application. Recognize and understand emotional coupling. Regardless of how logical we think we are, our first register of a new stimulus is emotional. Emotions travel faster to brain decision centers than rational thoughts. Any new input goes directly to the amygdala, then to the hippocampus to attach meaning. Then it goes to the forebrain to process consciously and intellectually to logically make sense and become a conscious choice. Now, a footnote here. The hippocampus is the primary location of the unconscious. It's where meanings are attached. This is why what someone associates to you and to your company or to your offer is so important. Our state of mind, the software package, determines the meaning we attach to a stimulus. And the meaning then determines our behavior. That's why state always comes first, then strategy and story. Each state of mind, since it's its own software program, contains its own beliefs, associations, and set of experiences. Here's a really simple example of how state of mind determines meaning and then behavior. You're at home relaxing after dinner with your partner. You're having a glass of wine, a great conversation. There's a noise in the backyard. You likely don't notice it, or if you do, you dismiss it. next evening, you're home alone. You've just watched Criminal Minds. It's Wednesday evening. Don't ask me how I know that. And you hear the same noise. You're alert to it. You're vigilant. You check it out. Same stimulus. Your state of mind determines the meaning and then the behavior. Everything at the lower emotional brain and midbrain are unconscious processes. The emotional activation registers before cognitive areas of the brain come into play to assess options. In fact, neuroeconomics research demonstrates that we make decisions, especially buy, purchase decisions, up to 10 seconds before we're even consciously aware. Once we unconsciously make an emotional commitment to a yes or to a no, these lower brain structures send the conscious mind on a mission to gather all the logical reasons to support that decision. We then cherry-pick data to support the pre-selected belief. We find something logical and sensible for it to light on, even if it's not accurate cause and effect. The rationalization becomes a confirmation bias. We inhabit the story we want to believe. The failure to notice contradictory data becomes an inattention blindness. When we make a choice, we couple memory from past experiences with the best guesses of a likely future. Our lives are determined by our choices. Those choices are informed by what we focus on and then shaped by the meaning that we attach. The part of the brain that anticipates pleasant outcomes, the nucleus accumbens, is what puts out a little bit of dopamine, the pleasure chemical. That activates a buy decision. A don't buy decision originates in a very different part of the brain, the insula. It's an area involved in anticipating pain. So the anticipatory emotions bias as well as drive decision-making. Think about a practical application of this. When someone gets excited about the possibility of purchasing something, not the actual purchase, but the almost purchase of it, that's what boots out some dopamine. So credit cards decouple buying, the activation of the pleasure center, and paying, the activation of the pain center in the brain. The pleasure of the purchase is segmented from the pain of future payment. The segmentation renders repayment a future abstraction, and our optimism bias even suggests that we'll have more money later or next month. That may be why people purchase 23% more when they do it with credit card than with cash or check. Another application here, it's hard to save because of the way our minds work and our brains are wired. It's hard to resist the immediate pleasure of buying and that dopamine hit. Making and spending money both activate the pleasure center mediated by dopamine. So it's difficult to substitute a theory, an abstraction, such as a future need, long-term saving, retirement, for the immediate payoff. That's why we have to have a plan. So let's look now at regulation of states of mind. And again, your state of mind, a particular software program you use, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. There are two primary ways, two best ways to regulate your state of mind: physiology and focus. Physiology is how you use your body, your biochemistry, to change your state of mind. So basic tools here include a brief relaxation, deep breathing, or a brief focused meditation. And a simple example is to take one deep breath in of relaxation and breathe out any tension and focus on exactly what you want. So the second part, focus. It's what and how you direct your conscious attention. Again, from quantum physics and the brain, you get what you focus on, not what you want. Focus aligns your energy field. What you focus on, what you pay attention to, determines your state of mind. our minds work by consciously selecting the one focus that we want to register at any moment. By holding this one thing in conscious awareness, we give relative inattention to everything else. This means we have an immediacy bias. We assign undue weight to whatever we pay attention to at this moment. Now, from a coaching perspective, the questions we ask determine what we focus on. A question directs the focus and thus determines the state that you're in. Let me give you an example. I was asked to do a workshop recently at a Vistage group. It's a group of CEOs. The Vistage chair is a buddy of mine, indicated that two of her members, one was a CEO and another a business owner, had each experienced challenging incidents at their companies. One involved an accident with a loss of life. Both incidents had created stress in the executives and the organization that remained unresolved. I discussed with them, with the group, and it's kind of a mastermind group setting. Some of you may be familiar with this. I discussed how we're always asking ourselves questions, even as we wake up, before we're even consciously aware of the process, and that those questions boot up a mindset that initiates the engagement with the day. Worry or negative questions, or even stubbing your toe as you get up, each can launch the first few hours of a day in a negative way. And both of these individuals said that they were aware as soon as they woke up of questions like, what's going to go wrong today? Can I really do this? So I suggested to them and to the group this exercise. Sometime before you go to bed, write down three questions that would create a positive, powerful state of mind. And as soon as you wake up in the morning, before your feet even touch the floor, take the paper and answer the question. As soon as you turn on your bedside lamp, feel the answer to each of the three questions that put you in an empowered, positive state. For example, what will I create today that will be more powerful than I ever dreamed of? The feedback I got in less than 1 week, both executives created a positive turnaround in focus, attitude, and engagement for themselves and their organization. Asking effective questions determines a state of mind. This is your power of focus. Ask habitual questions that empower you. The best mentors, leaders, teachers are the ones who ask the best questions to get us to use our own resources. The first application to yourself, next to your client, in that order. So let's look at optimum performance state of mind. The difference between a professional and an amateur, and I'll use those as two kind of icons of opposite ends of the spectrum, between massive success or less, is the ability to manage your state of mind, to achieve and sustain a peak performance state. So here's a mindset formula for optimizing persuasion. Find the challenge or the problem, the deep want or interest that's unfulfilled. We've discussed that before. Show prospects how to solve the problem or meet the challenge. Associate positive consequences when they do, and perhaps associate negative consequences if they don't. Those may already exist, in fact, so it doesn't need to be focused on. This mindset formula of persuasion associates buying with getting pleasure and not buying with pain, the two most basic motivations that we have as human beings, seek pleasure and avoid pain. And people will do more to avoid pain than to seek pleasure, which is risk aversion, if we discussed before. This is why the focus on results and consequences becomes more effective, the positive focus. The primary reason that we do something, this is so important. The primary reason that we do what we do is how we imagine we'll feel when we do it. The persuasion process is centered on getting the prospect to clearly associate the most desired feeling or state with your product or service. The three primary reasons someone fails to persuade: not consistently managing the mindset, and this is often the difference between success and failure. No compelling purpose during a challenging time, or simply a negative focus, limiting belief such as, it won't work, I've tried it before, I don't think I can do it. Of the insights that neuroscience brings to the business world, one of the most powerful is the ability to understand how a consumer connects various concepts about your brand at an unconscious level. It's crucially important to have a clear and exact understanding of the individual elements that make up the existing unconscious perceptions of a product or a service. This is the subject of our fourth seminar on neuromarketing. Think about how people love people who change their state. That's why entertainers are paid so much more than educators. Pro athletes way more than service people. We want to be around people who change our state for the better. Let's apply that to your business. Selling is transferring emotion. Your state of mind will have emotional contagion. Manage your state because it induces a state in others. You associate positive or negative emotions and state to your services or product. Then so does your prospect. If you're not in a peak state, such as feeling down or with a lesser expectation, that's also going to be emotionally contagious. Authentic energy is contagious. When your story truly excites you and you let that excitement show, it will be infectious to prospects. Your authenticity of genuine enthusiasm and conviction will resonate with prospects. Now, here's a question to consider, and you probably each experience this. Why can someone who begins at a peak state with a prospect come across as hyper or like a typical salesperson that turns the prospect off? The answer, they don't begin with where the prospect is. Remember, the first step is to empathically resonate, to become attuned, and find a way to communicate that shared experience. The result co-creates a common ground, a reciprocal connection. Then the client or prospect will go someplace new with you to follow your lead to arrive stepwise at the same place. I mentioned this just briefly in discussion in the first seminar. Many years ago, when I was still practicing psychoanalysis, I had a very succinct and powerful lesson about this principle from a very accomplished woman executive in analysis with me. Remember, I mentioned that I offered an interpretation to her that I thought was a particular insight, and she paused and then finally rose up on one elbow, turned around to look at me and say directly, "No, Kruger, first you have to be with me before I can go someplace new with you." That is a brilliant, simple, succinct synopsis of this principle. So consider these questions for your own reflection. How much money, how many prospects have you lost because you haven't been in a peak state in the last 3 months, in the last 3 years? How much has it cost you emotionally, regret, pain, less energy, less money, of not being in a peak state in the last 3 months, in the last 3 years? In the next 10 years, what will it cost you if you don't master this ability? In the next 10 years, what if you operate at peak state and enjoy the process? Listen to my grandmother. You're not having fun, you're not doing it right. Selling is the transference of emotion. You associate your state to your product or service. People associate your state to your product or service. People buy a state. State changing is activating. So the mindset management principles here. State is what you're selling way more than a product or a service. Selling is influencing the products, the prospect's focus, the value, the benefits, the pleasure, and the avoidance of pain. questions determine what we focus on and the state we're in. And the mindset of self-reflection fosters thoughtfulness, depth, and wisdom. So, match your optimum state of mind to the specific task. Anchor yourself for success. Peak performance comes from being in a peak state. It may be by focus and physiology, a focus freeze and a deep breath, or by a brief relaxation meditation. Remember, your optimum state for some things, such as a presentation, may be to energize yourself and generate optimism. For other things, the optimum state, like working with a client, may be to get fully centered and grounded. Or to go to sleep, it may be a state of full relaxation. So you want to effectively enter an optimum state for the task to create a match. Now, a word about how confidence is a state of mind. We know from numerous neuroscience studies that emotions and states of mind are contagious by an energy field transfer from amygdala to amygdala, person to person. Einstein referred to this as the unified field theory. He emphasized that we are each a bundle of energy and interact with another person who's also a bundle of energy. And those energy fields intersect and interact. The same with each person and the collective energy field of a group of other people. Confident is a state of mind. People naturally associate confident with expertise. The induction of a shared experience, a mutual influence of energy fields, plays a role in our affinity for confident people. Remember the Mindset Mastery Quiz, the Carnegie Mellon study? The major factor for professionals earning the trust of others, the confidence of the professional. Simple, confident explanations trump expertise. Mirror neurons and energy fields resonate with another's emotional state and influences behavior. And here are two things to especially remember. Confidence is more correlated with success than competence or expertise. Confidence is what initially engages someone. It's what people will pay you for. Since we know that confidence is a significant predictor and determinant of success, be aware of conscious and unconscious biases. For example, in studies with business school graduates, men initiate salary increases 40% more than women do. And when both ask, women ask for 30% less than men. At Manchester Business School in England, Professor Marilyn Davidson says, been doing this for 7 years, and every year there are massive differences between the male and female responses. The male students expect to earn significantly more than the women. And when you look at what the students think they deserve to earn, again, the differences are huge. You can never earn more in the outside world than you can earn in your own mind. If you earn 10% more or less than that income thermostat, you may automatically and unconsciously engage in automatic behaviors and patterns to reestablish the status quo, to move the thermostat back to the set point. You have to achieve it in your mind to change the thermostat before you can change it in reality. And remember this, once something unconscious becomes conscious, it's no longer unconscious. We always present in a manner consistent with our self-concept, just as we do in any role that we play. A self-concept regulates every aspect of our life, the software that drives our behavior. Confidence is a state of mind that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. For example, if you do everything except close a discussion by making a specific professional recommendation to a client about your services and your fee, your self-concept in that area needs to be addressed. The professional must always maintain the initiative. You've never heard other professionals like doctors or attorneys say something wishy-washy like, well, do you think it would be helpful for us to work together? The professional makes a specific, confident recommendation. You don't let the guy with the shovel decide how many elephants are in the parade. So, consider this. What's the best time to make a sale? After a vacation? When you're really relaxed? When you have debt? Or a dry spell? No, no, and no. The best time to make a sale is right after a sale. Confidence is a state of mind. Sustaining an optimum state is as important as changing a negative state. The major thing that holds the salesperson back is the fear of rejection that the prospect may say no. So, two simple practical applications from the mind and brain science. Anything you do to avoid the possibility of being rejected ensures it. And the major thing that keeps you from getting what you want is your story about why you can't get what you want. A couple of things now about conversational intelligence. Neuroscientists show us that the first few words of a conversation boots up a particular mindset in the listener to process the remainder of the exchange. A conversation that begins, for example, with authoritative, critical, or adversarial remarks activates the brain circuitry of fight and flight. This reaction is processed by the cortisol-adrenaline neurochemical system. The listener then closes down for self-protection. Now, consider another beginning. The conversation begins in a collaborative, collegial mode, activates the brain's neurochemical system of bonding and connection that induces listening without judgment to pay full attention. This initial collaborative trusting response is mediated by oxytocin, which frames the remainder of the sentence and the conversation. The listener feels safe and understood, and trust develops with further collaboration to optimize performance and results. Your opening remark determines whether the prospect will listen to you. So, it needs to be planned word for word and said so it sounds like you talking. In the first 10 words, people will decide if they're going to listen to you or not. So, don't begin with, well, here's how I would answer that. You've already used 7, you only got 3 words left. All successful sales are based on one factor, a relationship. People don't buy from people they don't like, and people can't sell to people they don't like. Enthusiasm counts for more sales closing than any other factor. The transfer of enthusiasm changes the state of the other person. Confidence begets enthusiasm. So, just a couple of words now about a mastery model. Consider your body of work as the process of a creative mindset, a series of experiments that can be interesting, intellectually stimulating, like solving a puzzle. The mindset is what activates new pathways and neuronal networks in your brain. And this is really in your outline. I just want to highlight a couple of things and get you to look more carefully at developing this, because it's some information, especially about looking for models, about defining the phases for your business, and some examples, and considering, for example, what's the next thing you want to add to your body of work, same as defining the phases, and then to focus on the basics, to look at giving attention to every aspect of your products and services. Everything you do and produce needs to be totally professional. So look at how you develop that from the perspective of the individual who's listening or reading. And as you consider doing all of this, and as you read and look at more detail than I'm going through now, think like a scientist. And a science is more a process than a body of information. As a scientist, keep an open mind about whether what you're doing works or not. Evaluate all feedback. Open and obtain a full range of feedback from all sources. A scientist creates a working hypothesis, tests it, observes with curiosity, asks why, tweaks, retests, observes. And think about this in the very simplest way that I can think about saying what we do in coaching. If something's working, you do more of it. If it's not working, you do something else. One final revisit to something we talked about before, the circle of persuasion. We touched on this just briefly in the discussion, but I want to elaborate it and then still save a few minutes for discussion. Imagine your audience is a person you're trying to persuade. To visualize this, draw a stick figure to represent this person. On a whole sheet of paper, draw a stick figure. Then draw a big circle around the stick figure. So that divides things into two parts. Someone who understands the world the way the stick figure does belongs inside the circle, next to the stick figure. People who don't understand the way the stick figure does belong outside the circle. That stick figure is your prospect. Your first job to communicate effectively is to get in the circle. So the challenge is this. If your prospects do not see you as belonging in that circle, they're not going to listen. Your point of view will not be seriously considered. You'll remain an outsider with little influence. Outside, nobody's going to listen to you. To enter, identify your prospect's biggest challenge. Resonate with that experience. Articulate the challenge of the pain point as clearly as you can. This moves you into the circle. Listen carefully. Identify what kind of emotions your prospects feel. Then put yourself in their shoes and ask why they're feeling that way, their specific challenges. You have to resonate with where they are and find a way to communicate that understanding before they'll admit you to their circle. Now, here's a, I think, a really good description of how the circle technique works. It's by a Wall Street Journal writer of how Obama began winning presidential primaries. People were puzzled about how he was charming voters in the heartland, where he shouldn't be seen in much favor at the time. Reporter Stephen Hayes followed Obama around and analyzed his circle strategy. When he addressed a contentious issue, Mr. Obama almost always begins his answer with a respectful nod in the direction of the view he's rejecting, a line or two that suggests he understands or perhaps even resonates with the concerns of the conservative. He moves into the circle. Remember Lincoln's approach to arguing the case. He cited an example in which Obama was asked about the Second Amendment. He began his answer by saying that after having taught constitutional law for 10 years, he believed that the Second Amendment granted individuals the right to carry guns, the conservative position, and that he respected the right of lawful gun owners to hunt and protect their families. Only then, after he was in the circle, did Obama go on to talk about how he thought there should be new laws to help trace firearms used in crimes. At the end of the answer, Obama employed one final circle move, kicking his opponent out. He said, "The argument I have with the NRA is that they believe any constraint or regulation whatsoever is something that they have to beat back. And I don't think that's how most lawful firearm owners think." So Obama's left standing next to the lawful firearm owners, his audience, inside the circle, while the NRA has just been declared bereft of common sense, not like us, outside the circle. Winning means not only getting inside, it also means pushing your opponent out, not directly, not by saying anything negative about your opponent, as in this example. So forget about that part of this example. The circle vision suggests that to bring your audience over to your side, the first move is to go where your audience is. Connect with them, then you can move forward together. Now, here's a Girl Scout variation of entering the circle. Most Girl Scouts are taught to memorize a fairly complicated spiel, one that involves introducing themselves, talking detail about the good work that the Scouts do, and finishing with how the money raised goes for great purposes. Now, this is tough work even for a professional. You guys know this, but for a kid talking to an adult stranger can be scary, especially behind a whole mountain of Girl Scout cookies. There's an alternative that more than doubles the sales rate, however. It's the question, what's your favorite kind of Girl Scout cookie? Questions focus our brains, and the first words determine a state of mind. In 10 words or less, as a beginning of a conversation, all the nostalgic memories of Cookie's past are summoned in that one simple question. The power and the transaction shift with the Girl Scout going from requesting to supplying. It's also a question that avoids a no, a question that starts a conversation, and a question that opens the door to emotion. Those are the kind of questions that create value and build careers. The experience from the buyer's point of view is an emotional connection to something that's been in his or her life since being a kid. There's a reason they don't change the flavors of those Girl Scout cookies, as well as a positive reaction when a young person learning to speak up. Selling a state of mind far outpaces only selling Thin Mint cookies. Changing a strongly held belief has more to do with storytelling than with facts or logic. Storytelling is emotional and persuasive. Stories are way more powerful than data because they allow us to identify emotionally with ideas and people that we may otherwise disregard or see them as outsiders. We tend to align with people who share our identity, even if the facts disagree. So, here's some bullets, a mindset mastery summary. These are in your outline, but I want to just highlight them in bullet. People buy for emotional reasons and justify with logic. Emotions drive us. Find the emotional reasons for buying now, and find the logical reasons for buying. The purpose of a conversation, written or spoken, is to find the prospect's needs and mutually create conviction. Conviction starts with you first, then the prospect. Selling is the transfer of emotion. For someone to buy, they must feel certain they'll get what they want. When two people interact, the person with the greater confidence will influence the other. Prospects have to buy for their reason, not yours. And facilitate the prospect's conviction that they will get what they want out of your service or product by matching their core identity, their core value. Find the predominant emotional reason for buying. Remember, they'll translate it into logical reasons, and they can know best their logical reasons rather than you. For brain processing, do one feature at a time, not the whole list. Keep it simple. Shrink the chain. The authentic connection and how you say will make more difference than what you say. And finally, consistently focus on prospects' benefits, values, and avoiding pain. And just before I go on discussion mode, there's an additional resource some of you are familiar with I wanted to highlight. At the very center of my homepage, MentorPath, there is about a 35-minute webinar on Master States of Mind at MentorPath, MentorPath.com. You'll see it immediately when you click there. And I think it might be helpful if you're interested in pursuing more about mastering states of mind. Hold on, and we will be on discussion mode. Okay, we're in discussion mode. If you'll manage background noise, I'm interested in thoughts, questions, various takes on what we just talked about.
This is Kip.
Yeah, hey, Kip. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing fine. Resonating again with the body breath, and then going in and refocusing the mind. Even though stress originates in the mind, it's important to start with the gross and move towards the subtle with the body, some kind of stretching, movement, breath, and then it's easier to focus a mind when the body's more relaxed. And so thanks for reminding me of that. And I use the neural conditioning chart that you created with those components in it to go from the trigger to the state of mind that will then move us into the desired inner condition. So thank you for reminding me of all of that.
Yeah, thanks for highlighting that, Kip. And as you know from all the training that you do in mindfulness and meditation, that the place of being grounded and centered, of being fully grounded and centered, that is the place that we are in that allows us access to all the information and all the states of mind, the full scope and range of what we know, how we can interact, how we can optimally be intuitive and resonant empathically with our clients. So that's the primary thing. For example, before I take a call from a client, I work totally by telephone with my mentor coaching clients, I will do a brief 1 minute or less focused meditation, relaxation, a mantra to get really grounded and centered so that I can be totally immersed in what we're about to engage in with the client. And Kip mentioned the neuroconditioning chart. There's a systematic way to do this for any emotional trigger that you'll see on the webinar. It's something that I've developed and tried in a number of ways, and coaches who have trained with me have found it very useful. Oh, I want to mention, this is totally self-serving now. Speaking of all the times I, nudge that you shy away from that, I wanted to mention that this Wednesday, 2 days from now, I'm beginning the 2017 training for New Money Story Mentors. It's a teleconference online training for licensed specialty certification. It covers not just money stories, but life, wellness, relationship, and all that, but focused more for professionals who will deal with people from financial to coaches who deal with money stories as well as other stories. So you'll see. The link is newmoneystorymentor.com. So, thanks. Other thoughts or questions? Or comments? I'm interested in what your take is on this.
Your quote was from John Lennon.
Yes, absolutely. I garbled it just a little bit, enough so that it wasn't exactly plagiarizing, but it was close enough that I wouldn't print it.
Yeah. I was impressed, though. I was impressed.
Yeah, and you didn't let me get away with that, but it was just
in the
perspective time that I don't quote. See, that's
but
the
it's
beauty
such a good
of,
quote.
For me personally
it's
of why I've gone. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I was talking over you.
It's
go
just
ahead.
Such a – you were giving us such a great quote to give people and for ourselves. So I don't care if you got it off the ceiling in the bathroom at the gas station, really.
Yeah. Well, that's what I found so beneficial from 25 years of doing, professional writing as a shrink, as a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, and then moving over a decade ago to coaching. My writing now, I don't have to do all that referencing. I do attribution, and I reference names and sources, but I don't have to do all that references and getting all the semicolons right. It's a real freedom. When I dictate from what I'm thinking and reading, I'll make a reference, but that's enough, and that's great because I don't want to burden people with, where and what journal I found that or how I concluded that. So that to me has been one of the real freedoms and why writing is even so much more pleasurable now than it was even then. Other thoughts? I noticed we're out of time. I wasn't watching the time. If there are any other questions or comments or anything at all, fire me an email and I will I will respond. It won't be another Tom Sawyer story, but we're going to talk in our final seminar next time about neuromarketing and maybe bring some things together and apply this in ways that I hope will be beneficial. So anything else that we didn't have time for, send me an email. thank you all very, very much. I appreciate it.
Thank
you. I appreciate all the comments and emails I have received. So,
thank you.
Till next time. Yeah,
thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.